Jai Ma. So, the subject is spiritual freedom and feminism from the integral yoga perspective. Now, just a sentence of the mother opens doors of numerous possibilities. In fact, it is the key to all the problems. And that's how the mother puts it. It's in one of her conversations in volume 2. And this was in a talk to women of Japan, on which she elaborates in 1955. And the what she says is that the problem of feminism, like all other problems, is essentially a spiritual problem. Now, this is very interesting because, I'm just a little bit digressing. For instance, poverty. Poverty is only a political problem, a physical problem, ideative problem, or a spiritual problem. Now, when we look at everything, we have to go back to the roots. And when it is said it's a spiritual problem, what it means is that there is an original divine plan or a divine impulsion which over a period of time, as it descends down through creation, it gets wrapped and covered by layers of ignorance, gets distorted, diminished, limited, and ultimately it presents itself a picture which we see today. So if we have to correct it, we have to first go back to the root. That's what it means, because that's where we have the original plan. So I'm putting it in a very human way, that there is an original plan, and it is the same plan on which everything in creation runs. And we have to first get back to that original plan, that what really is the plan? Why is it just a random event that there are men and women, or masculine and feminine gender? Or there is a deeper sense within it. If there is a deeper sense within it, we need to discover it. This is important because there are two perspectives from which we can approach it. One, that there is no divine plan, there is no, nature is a blind force, and we as human beings have to rectify what nature has done wrong. So this is one way we try to correct it. For example, there is this modern idea that, you know, whether you are a man or a woman, all is same. You can be a man in the morning, woman in the evening, and it's all the same. Now, this is because we have not tried to really understand where the problem is. We are trying to solve it because there is a disparity, there is an inequality, which is fine. It needs to be addressed. But we are trying to solve it at a level by being at the same level. This is one part. Second is, there is the other ignorant way of dealing with it, that, you know, there is a kind of activism. Now, first of all, when I say ignorant, I mean it's not that it is invalid. It simply means that we can try it, but it doesn't really work out because we have not understood where the problem lies. And it's a problem of whole of creation, that there is a truth and there is a distortion. So, again, as I said, that there is an ignorant way of dealing with it, that, well, men and women are equal, they should have parity, gender parity. Again, there is a quite true. And it goes on to, you know, absurd levels where women should not only dress like men, maybe men should dress like women. Why not? But that's not the point. Point is that this is where we are getting lost. Or they should drink and smoke. There was a time when instead of making men, you know, more beautiful beings, women started in imitating men, they became, you know, worse and worse. One of the facts that the mother mentions is, I think it was one of the parliaments in Sweden, or probably Sweden or Switzerland, one of the Scandinavian countries, I may be mistaken, where when the women, one of the first women member of the parliament, so the mother says when she came, the first thing she abolished was drunkenness. So drunkenness became a crime. So she uses that, you know, how women would operate is the other way around, that women should also drink and smoke, and that's the sign of women liberation. So we are not getting at the real problem. And the third ignorant way of solving it, which again we try to give it a spiritual coloring, is that, well, all this is man, woman, all these differences, duality, they're all illusion. So basically there is neither man nor woman. And then one begins to say that, well, neither man nor woman, everything is same, because there is no such reality. In which case there is no problem because it's all an illusion. So this again does not really solve the problem. It cuts the Gordian knot rather than untying the knot. So the essence of it is that there is a truth of the spirit in the gender differentiation. The differentiation becomes division. Division hardens into a complete separation, and that is the problem. It's a problem of whole of creation. That there is a truth and it gets distorted. So it's not an illusion but a distortion. So first we must get at the true plan. What is the original plan? So if we go back to the original plan, we see it for instance in the Nasadiya Sukta and others, that how creation starts. So creation starts when, and several stories are connected to it, let me not go into it. Even in the biblical fall, well, it's very interesting that it is the feminine who apparently tempts the masculine element to eat the apple, basically the apple of knowledge. So what really we see is that there is the Purusha who has within him, or it or him, because then it is only it, there is no Purusha and Shakti. So he holds within him infinite possibilities which are waiting to manifest. But just like a writer who cannot express anything unless he has the prerana, unless he has the inspiration, the pen, the ink, the paper and everything else, he may have all the possibilities of writing a Mahabharata, Ramayana and Iliad and Odyssey and everything else, but it will be just within. So when the one who is neither masculine nor feminine wants to, is moved to create by his own Shakti, by his own power. Why is he moved to create? To know himself. That's the beautiful part of it. That he needs to know himself, and to know himself, he needs to bring out all that is inside him, become aware. So consciousness and force come out and the Shakti comes out. And that Shakti begins to bring out all the countless possibilities and the creation starts. So if we go back to that root, we see that the one becomes two. One is the power that holds within himself itself as the, as knowledge, the fundamental idea of creation or existence. And the second is the same one. The second part is that it receives that seed of creation and manifests itself in countless ways. A woman becomes the creatrix or the creative, organizing, materializing, actualizing power of the Purusha. So there are now these two roles that the one has assumed. One where the seeds are cast into the womb of the feminine, which becomes Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. She receives those seeds and then she lets it out in a creative outburst of splendor. So from there we see that in nature certain masculine and feminine aspects come, which largely in Sanskrit language, at least in Hindi language and some other, more or less tries to reflect this deeper reality. For instance, sun is masculine. The rays, kiran, that is feminine. Because if, without the kiran, you, sun is sun, it remains where it is. But what is that which helps the sun to reach the earth and create seasons and create all the, you know, possibilities which are hidden inside the sun? And that is the feminine aspect, the kiran, the rays, they come and touch the earth. Similarly, we see very interestingly that all the planets, as far as I know, Mangal, Shukra, Brihaspati, Shani, Rahu, Ketu, I don't know, there are probably some more, they are generally masculine names. You know, you attach them, Shani is masculine, Rahu is masculine, Ketu is masculine, Jupiter is masculine, but Earth, Prithvi, is feminine. Because of all these planets, Prithvi is the one which brings out creative potential which is held back within matter. So she becomes the feminine. The mountain is masculine. And from the heart of the mountain, from its peaks and summits, out of the snow, rivers flow which give life. They bring life on the plains, and therefore rivers become feminine. the sea which again receives becomes masculine. So we see that by and large, I'm not saying that always we can apply, pushp is masculine, the sugandh is feminine. It is the fragrance and all the elements within the fragrance which go far, which draw certain, you know, for the pollination and all that that happens. It serves that purpose. So we see that the masculine element is essentially that which holds within itself the possibilities, the potentials, like the mind. That's why the mind is often the man is regarded as generally living in the mind. Why? Because he lives in the realm of ideas. So he has within the mind, mind is the realm where ideas come. But to actually manifest these ideas into earthly life, one needs the feminine element. So very few people, for example, can combine idea and practicality. Very few. Those who have done it, like, you know, Shivaji Maharaj was one of them who combined idea and practicality. But you can say that the practical side as well as that, he was deeply inspired by his mother. The feminine element is always behind. So there is the masculine element, there is the feminine element. And where the two come together, one which receives and the other expresses, then life becomes wonderful. So women are made like that, that they are more intuitive, because to express the idea, you have to receive it and manifest it. Why intuitive? Because there is no fixed processes. The moment men try to express it, though I have come prematurely to man and woman, we can go from the animal level. So basically when we try to express the idea rationally, it is very difficult, because reason keeps weighing pros and cons, and it even to understand the idea is very difficult for reason. But women being more intuitive, they receive an idea in a flash. And when they receive the idea, so see, woman is the inspiration and she is the manifestation. So both aspects, and that's how the original plan of creation goes. Now, so far it's wonderful, and we see such prototypes like that in the ancient scriptures. We have, you know, for instance, Rishi Agastya and Lopamudra, many of these rishis were, but for their feminine counterpart who actually expressed the idea in real terms, they were not only managing the Gurukul, but many aspects of the Gurukul, the entire organization, expression, management was taken care of by the feminine side. With Agastya and Lopamudra, it's very, very prominent, because both of them are engaged in yoga, and so Lopamudra fully is aware what is it that the Rishi is trying, and they both strive toward the same goal. And in modern times, the one example that we can see very clearly is Shurbindra and the mother. So what I'm saying is there is a difference between a man being from the mind leaping into the spiritual plane, and the woman basically looking after things, but she as a kind of reverence, out of reverence for the man, as a part of a dharma, but not really climbing to that height. Little bit we see touching that height in Sri Ramakrishna and Sharada Devi's example. We also see in Swami Vivekananda and Sister Nivedita's example. I mean, not that they are married, but that's not really important. So this is the height to which human consciousness has gone. And as I said, the ultimate truth of it has been revealed by Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Often people ask me that what is the relation? Are they married? Now we have to come out of these frameworks. Human mind has created certain orders, social orders, because it wants to create stability. So this basic differentiation was later on fixed by society into a man and woman, different types of relation, father and daughter and wife and husband and brother and sister, which are okay for the sake of social order. They were necessary. But if we try to make them as ultimate gospel truths, then we miss the point. That's not the point at all. The feminine is who manifests what the masculine holds within as the idea. That we see in the mother and Sri Aurobindo's life. Sri Aurobindo himself says in 1914 or little later, not 1914, mother has come. Little later somebody asked what has been the role of mother in your own life. He says that before the mother's coming, I could help myself, but I could not have helped others. And then he even says that all the truths that I knew and realized would have remained at the ideative level. We see so beautifully, actually it's an ideal example of what a masculine and feminine ideal harmony and truth of their nature should be. It's not about childbirth. It's not about a woman is cooking and a man is enjoying and he is going out to do the labor and a woman is inside the house. All these are distortions which have come, and we'll talk about it in a moment. But Mother and Shurbindo both are spiritually ascended beings. I'm using a human language. Both have realized the truth of the divine within themselves, but their roles are so interesting that while Shurbindo has brought these ideas at the level of the mind through the wonderful works, the mother puts them into practice and makes them very practicable chunks in a conversation with disciples, practicable truths which can be practiced. She organizes, she manifests the entire ashram, society, Auroville, Shurbindo Action, many organizations are essentially, basically, she has brought that truth of Shurbindo and she has expressed it in countless ways. And this process continues because she is infinite Shakti, and so the manifestation is not going to end just with a, you know, what we call outwardly as a lifetime. So this is the ideal relation. But what it became, now this is where Shurbindra and the mother do course correction. And we see the course correction actually begins with Sri Ramakrishna and Sarada Devi, where he asks her on the night of marriage whether you want to be the mother of one child or mother of many children or the world mother. And she says, I want to be the world mother. And he bows at her feet and says, Ma. So basically we see something very similar when Dilip Kumar Roy asked once the mother that you and Shurbindo are very good friends, it seems. Of course, behind the question there was this consciousness which wanted to justify certain things. And the mother became quiet and then she says, you know, he calls me mother. Now, Shurbindo always addressed mother as mother, and there is a very beautiful incident where earlier he used to use the word Meera Devi. Then one day, then toward the later part of evening talk, this all in 20s, early 20, before 26, somewhere around 25 perhaps or 24, people notice that while he is using the word Meera, there is a halt at M, as if he is wanting to say something else and the word Meera comes out. People noticed it. Nalinda speaks about it. Till one day he suddenly said mother. So Nalinda beautifully says that that was the day that the mother was fixed in the outer consciousness of man. So Shurbindo always called her mother. Mother is the womb of all creation. And the mother called him the Lord. And she described the relation in a very beautiful way, that without him, I exist not. Because see, it is out of the Ishwara that the Shakti comes out. So she exists in and by the Ishwara. But then she adds, without me he is unmanifest. So the task given or taken up by the Shakti to manifest all the possibilities in the Ishwara. This is the highest kind of relation which we will see in the future. There is no childbirth here, but something else, many offsprings. We often hear that rishis used to create many offsprings. They were even, Kardam Rishi gets a command to have many offsprings. Now, these offsprings here are to create those Tejasvi children of the future, like mother. We are all mother's offspring. And, you know, we can say that Shurbindra and the mother are our divine parent. So, how it gets now distorted? Take for instance offspring. So there is a spiritual motherhood where we have offsprings who are nothing but some portions of the energy of the feminine, and this energy that she holds is in direct alignment with the truth of the masculine, and then they are she is expressing it through so many let's say students, and like in Gurukul the Guruma who would come, and the Guruma, as I said, was not just housekeeper. No, where Guruji was only giving the Upadesh. No, She was of an equal stature, realized being, of equal realization. So this is very important, because it's not like she is not realized, man is realized, and he just transmits the power. That was a possibility in Sri Aurobindo's own life when he writes to Mrilalini Devi that, will you be my Shakti? If you just come along, everything will develop in you. You don't have to do anything. This was one possibility, but later on we see that something much greater manifested through Sri Aurobindo and the mother. Now, where does the distortion come? Now, distortion comes as creation descends down the levels. When it comes to the human level, this is the original purpose of a man and a woman together as the ideative and the manifesting power, but both equally spiritually ascended. But that comes much later. Initially, there is the drag of the animal consciousness. So, a woman, instead of producing creative offsprings of light, she ends up producing children. So she produces children, because of which nature, inferior nature, we have to understand the double nature. In lower nature, things operate through the mechanism of ignorance. The same truth, but it expresses itself in little ways, distorted ways, diminished ways, just to fulfill nature's inferior purpose. Inferior purpose is she is just enjoying having population, playing around with it. She is enjoying her inferior game. So we see that nature creates feminine. Now, this is the game of ignorance, how it comes. So, masculine and feminine are there, but the difference is not in terms of the receiving power, not in terms of the, the power of knowledge and the power of manifestation or will. The difference is purely biological. It gets down to that. And in that, instead of receiving idea, she receives the seed of the man through a biological process. She nurtures in the womb and expresses in terms of a physical, biological child. Now, this is a plan on the animal level. Now, that carries on in man, and just to make sure that the two come close, there is a certain kind of mutual attraction. A woman gets attracted to man because of his strength or intellect. And a man gets attracted to woman because of certain qualities which are hidden inside him but not expressed, softness, tenderness, her ability to look after him, care, and then he becomes slowly dependent, as the mother says, three kinds of slaveries of man and a woman. So man is drawn towards a woman and gets enslaved. How does he get enslaved? By desire to have sexual relation. This is nature's inferior plan. So there is an inferior mode of relationship where man is attracted towards a woman to have sexual relation. Second is because of the little comforts of married life. So what are the little comforts? Instead of manifesting power which should serve the truth, she becomes in the service of the man, which is the inferior mode. So what does she do? She makes tea, makes food. This very inferior kind of mode of functioning. And obviously man enjoys it like a lord. And therefore we see the subsequent degeneration, but that's still later. And the third is that man begins to feel that he is the one from whom she takes the idea. This is the original plan, but here it changes or gets distorted into the will to dominate and possess. So these are the three things that make a man slave to a woman. And we know that its ultimate distortion is where a man regards woman as a child making factory, and you know, very wonderful names are given, but basically it's a very, very animal kind of relationship. Or he looks at woman as somebody who has been made to serve man and his needs, from sexual and food needs and everything else. He's a homemaker at its most glorified highest. And the third is that he must dominate and control. So a woman is supposed to listen to whatever he says. Now all this plus the menstruation problem, and if she has a child, it takes time. She has to, she can't easily move out freely. So we see that slowly she began to become housebound. So the distortion came there. So it became more and more a patriarchal society in that sense, where men dominated. Patriarchal is not the way we normally understand. So people sometimes, for example, say Ramayana is patriarchal. This is not really true, because In Ramayana, Ram goes to Vanvas because his mother, a stepmother, Kekai, his father has to keep a promise, and because of a woman he goes all the way, abandons his kingdom, renounces. Similarly, because of his wife, he marches on to Lanka and, you know, almost a mortal fight he undertakes. So that's not what is patriarchy, but patriarchy is where we see these three things. And I can think of only one religion where now still a strong patriarchy exists. And that patriarchy is where woman must be completely housebound. She should be wearing a dress where nobody sees her. She is the private property of the man. Only he can see her. She is meant for the pleasure of the man. She is meant for his cooking. She is meant for having children, too many children, as many children, and to rear them up. And look after, serve the man, and completely dominated by the man. Now, there is only one religion in the world which does it today, and I am not naming it because I have been told, no, don't name the religion. Okay, anybody can make a fair guess. Not even a fair guess, it's so obvious. But if at all this was there to an extent because of contamination, in India it came because of contamination with the Islamic invasion. And we see that Hindus have more or less discarded this. Hindu women go out, they work, and you know, they can choose now whether they want to have a child or not, no child. They don't necessarily listen to whatever the man says, because you're supposed to listen to truth. So we'll come to that a little later. So first is where the distortion took place. Similarly, we see that in the Christian world, in the Western world, this has changed more or less. So it was there maybe 100 years back under all this. Europe was facing a tussle with this extreme hardcore religious ideology. In India also it had an influence, but slowly Europe revolted. In India also we see it has reacted, and now that degree, extreme degree of suppression, oppression, or a fixed role, women begin to like it. But often people say, but what if the woman likes? Well, it's almost like, say, what if a person wants to take drugs or wants to see pornography? Now, there is no answer to that. Women like it. Some women like it partly because they are told that these are laws of religion and you must follow it, otherwise you will be condemned to hell. They are put under a lot of fear, and they also begin to like it. I know that there are really women who begin to like it, and I used to often wonder, well, it's the pack mentality or the herd mentality that, well, everybody must do what everybody decides. So there is nothing like an individual thought at all which goes into it. And also because they think because everybody is doing it is the right thing. So let's leave aside. But this is the ultimate degeneration and degradation of women. Now, why I have emphasized this? Because I see very paradoxically strange something in this world. That while there are voices being raised about women in emancipation, but this corner of the world where, or that corner of the world where there is a complete slavery, nobody is talking about it. I have had interactions with people, and they start talking about India. I said, forget about India. You first liberate women in Saudi Arabia, in Pakistan, and all this, Afghanistan. We'll talk about India later. But nobody speaks. So there is a falsehood which supports this whole process of slavery of women. So ultimately also women become slave. And why women become slave to men? Because of the desire for motherhood. They need to receive the seed. Again, the animal plan. Again, because they are attracted towards the man in some way or the other, and they feel the need for security and protection, which comes, they sort of begin to depend on the man. So these are the three things which make man and woman slave from each other, and both have to be free. It cannot just be a problem of women. As long as there are men who want to see women as a pleasure object, the world view will continue to be dominated by a certain kind of narrative. For example, see in the Western world. Now women are apparently emancipated. That's what we are told. But don't we see that in every advertisement, there would be a woman who is selling a product? So what has she become? She has become a instrument for selling a product. For she also earns some money, the man also earns some money, and invariably in those products a certain kind of stereotype of a woman: she should be this figure, she should be fragile, she should be fair, she should be good looking, by a certain idea of the Western world that she should be good looking. If you ask a Negro, he will say, no, a black is beautiful. But there is a kind of narrative which goes around, and today we see the entire advertisement world, the cinema industry, painted woman as a very fragile lady. Whenever you see the old time cinema, so a woman is always, you know, coy, she's shy, she has to depend on the man at everything, and the hero comes in, suddenly he kind of, you know, dishum, all the villains go away flying, and you know, now this stereotype is, again, this holds them captive, because you are again creating a narrative that a woman for everything must depend on a man. This stereotype must go. Or the stereotype of an ideal woman, we see in some of the movies where she comes home, then she becomes a homemaker, she cooks, she has a lovely child which she rears up. These are all stereotypes. They are okay for if one wants to continue with the ordinary life. But this is not the highest possibility of a man and a woman. This is where we must know. Now, how do we realize this highest possibility? Highest possibility we have seen is in the origin. First thing is, both must get free from the slavery to each other. The relation is not of mutual slaves who are sort of in a kind of business or a transactional relationship, as it is called. No, it should not be a transactional relationship. It should be a fulfilling relationship, wherein man realizes his fullest potential, the woman realizes her fullest potential. And then they come together. As I had read long back, one of the, I don't know who wrote this phrase, but it used to be one of my favorite just after my graduation AFMC days. And the phrase read something like this, two halves have no choice but to unite, because they make a whole. So two halves have no choice but to unite. But when two wholes come together and join, that is beauty, that is love. It struck me very beautifully. Both have to discover their own highest. So now there comes the role of spiritual freedom. Can a woman do it when she is continuing to be in this state of ignorance? At best, she will polish, cover, outside picture, a very dainty woman, well-dressed, which is okay, which is a good thing. And a man holding her by the arm, and you know, he is walking, he's providing her with all the money and everything. Now this is, it's okay. I mean, as I said, but it's an inferior relationship. There we have to say ultimately that, well, the difference is primarily biological, and the rest that is our contribution, we have made it sociological, and by giving it a religious sanction, we have hardened the division. But we have to go back to differentiation. So meaning thereby, both should be actual practitioners of yoga. So because there is no other way you can get rid of ignorance. No education, no degree of financial freedom. All these are important, because a woman must be financially free. Otherwise, she cannot really engage in that true spiritual freedom. Unless, of course, sometimes there are wonderful couples I've seen where they don't have this differential. But normally it is seen that if you are financially dependent on the man, somewhere or the other, you begin to accept certain things, because money plays a role in our outer life. So financial freedom is important. Women getting jobs and all this is important. That's part of the whole journey, and that's part of the whole development. But the real solution will come when a woman begins to get spiritually free. So she has to engage in some kind of yoga, spiritual life, whereby she begins to get rid of the ignorance within her. And this getting rid of ignorance, this is the real task. By ignorance means she must discover that she is not a man or a woman the way we have defined her, but she is a soul. Now, soul is very interestingly, everybody has the same soul. It's not like masculine soul and a feminine soul. So there's the first discovery. She gets rid of all these bandhan, these kinds of social impositions and the biological differences, which are unfortunately often crystallized, that in during periods you can't do this, you can't go to a, you know, temple, or you can't pray in a mosque. All these are meaningless things. They were rules of hygiene, but they became almost hardened. No, spiritual freedom is accessible to all. And everybody who has realized the
realm of the spirit and the higher consciousness automatically gets free. He cannot think in terms of a man and a woman. He thinks in terms of beings who are aspiring towards the common ideal. Now, lower nature may creep in. It's possible. That's why in certain monasteries, we see Buddha tried to, you know, have feminine monasteries. Swami Vivekananda, he started this feminine monastery. And the reason is that, well, but still they were segregated. That, well, why? Because both are striving. Both can strive. The path is the same. But because they are still part of the lower nature, they may come together and there may be an explosive reaction. Not because of anything else. Not because a woman is a snare to man. This is another very stupid mentality which Aurobindo counters by saying that medieval ascetics thought that, you know, a woman is made to tempt man. And then he says that, well, I think much more kindly of the divine who created man and woman, that this is. And then he even goes on to say, if a woman tempts thee, is it your fault or the woman's? So all these are because the lower nature is still active and playing. It's possible that in a setting, let's say in a monastery setting or an ashram setting, there is a possibility that a woman and a man, when they mix freely, the lower nature, the lower thing may get triggered and it may become active. So we will see that in many monasteries where spiritual practices are there, they are both striving towards spiritual freedom, yet they create a boundary wall. So this has been so far. Even ancient times, we see Christian monasteries where we have nuns. So they are dressed in certain ways that they don't look attractive. So basically, you are trying to put down the lower impulse and minimizing the chances. And then the brothers are staying separately. They do meet time to time, but this was the whole idea. But here we see something very radical and interesting in Aurobindo ashram. It's very unique because men and women stay together. By together, I mean not that they are in the same house. Yes, if they are married, they can, but they have to be individuals. So they are part of the same ashram. They meet together, they work together, they play together. They go to the same playground together, and woman learns everything that a man learns, from boxing, judo, karate, swimming and everything, as man does. Equally, men have an access to everything that is traditionally under the role of men. Women, for instance, in the ashram dining room, as far as I know, a lot of cooking is done by men. So she has done a very unique experiment in human relationship. And somebody asked, because the danger is there, of course. Somebody in Raman Ashram, someone had gone and asked one of the Swamijis that everywhere we see this, line for men, line for women, everywhere some kind of segregation. When people are sitting, this side there are men, this side there are women. It's all unconscious habits. Sometimes I see this in Aurobindo society organizations also, and I would tell them this is not how we operate. But anyway, so they do that. It's almost a mechanical habit. But in ashrams, they have this line for men, line for women. So he asked that, how come in Aurobindo ashram this doesn't have operate like that? And he's, because the, it's like putting ghee and fire together, it'll burn. So he gave a very interesting answer. He said they are divine, Aurobindo and the mother, so they can handle anything. And basically, it's not just about handling. They are this is a grand experiment laboratory, the Aurobindo ashram. And this experiment is how, even though the lower elements come, eventually we have to reach that point. So the challenge is to be taken, where human consciousness has to advance to a point where, instead of looking at people like a man and a woman, boy and a girl, and mother would often remind, why do you have to think that you are a boy or a girl? Both of you are soul. The first necessity is to get rid of this thought that you are a boy or a girl. And you have to then get into that stereotype role. All of you are equally her children, my children. And she says that, you know, all of you can equally realize the divine. There's nothing that boys can realize better, men can realize better, or women. Yes, the paths are different, as many people, as many paths. Women being more intuitive, more emotional, they are closer to the psychic. Men being more ideative, they have a tendency to go through the intellectual mind toward the spiritual consciousness. That's okay. But both can equally have the equal opportunity. So first step is to get rid of this idea. And in the ashram, which is a living laboratory for a spiritual evolution, we see by the sheer fact that we practice the yoga together, live together, meet together. We don't even have to put a facade that she's like my sister. Everybody is a Guru Bandhu. So everybody is an aspirant for the spiritual life. We are not asked that, you know, she, you have to address somebody as Didi and somebody as Dada. You can do that. That was much later. People were called by name in the ashram at one point of time. But later on, this Da and Di came because some people felt very odd. But this is how it was. That you have to go completely past the biology and the sociology to really discover the spirit. So unless we do that, the true spiritual freedom, this idea that she is the manifesting power and he is the, you know, ideative power will remain meaningless. So this is the first thing. We have to recover a spiritual freedom where we are neither man or woman as we understand it. We are all children of the divine and we discover the divine, become one with the divine. For that, all these foolish ideas that women should become like men in terms of dresses they wear, that's actually, if you look at it, that's slavery. Why not men? If you talk about equality in that sense, then yes, ask the men to wear sari and skirts. Why should a woman imitate? I mean, ideally speaking, it is absurd. Or you should smoke and drink. No, well, you should ask men to give up smoking and drinking. If you really want parity and equality, there also, why should women sacrifice her highest, noblest instincts for the sake of going down maybe several rungs further down just to become a imitation copy of a man in a different form? So we must understand this is not how any emancipation is going to come about. These are distortions of the original plan and the distortion which falsehood and unconsciousness wants to perpetuate. Why? Because the more people are caught up in this idea, the less they are going to look towards the true relationship between a man and a woman. As a woman comes out of this ignorance through spiritual life, through yoga, automatically, as what spiritual life does to us, we'll discover that for the man and the woman, now it's not about the biological thing, but there are some people who will be more and more ideative, and there would be some people who will be more and more expressing and manifesting. So that's where the masculine and feminine comes in. It's actually regardless of the gender, biological gender. So that's why when Sri Ramakrishna saw Swami Vivekananda, then Narendra come, he said, I was waiting for you. You are my Shakti, which has been so much misunderstood in the jaundiced eye of the psychoanalytical world. Similarly, the relation between Nizamuddin and Amir Khusro has been so much misunderstood by the world because of they couldn't understand that one brings the truth, the other expresses it. So the woman, if she is a feminine, let's put it now for the sake of understanding, the man must receive these ideative truths in the mind, receives these truths in the mind from the higher consciousness, from the spiritual realm, and the woman picks them up and expresses it through countless ways. She becomes the organizing and the manifesting power. In which case, also things which traditionally we speak about, taking care of the house. Now, that house is not just a small little house. That house is all that the man holds. Everything. She takes care of that, takes charge of that, and expresses because she is the organizing power. So, seen thus, we can understand that true relation. But before that also, there is much we can do if we really want to bring real equality between a man and a woman. The way is not free smoking, free drinking, free sexuality, pornography, male prostitute, God knows what all is, the worse than animal, rakshasic and pishachik way of life. But the right way would be in every sphere of work, which has been traditionally masculine, give the women an equal opportunity and chance, which is happening, at least in India, it's happening. I'm so happy and literally proud that, you know, women are flying fighter jets, which is how it should be. They should be members of parliaments, those who decide. I mean, recently in the Delhi election, I mean, I'm making a non-political, apolitical statement. So nice to see a lady chief minister. There was another lady chief minister from another party a few years back. which is something so beautiful, because this is the way. So we have a lower, even within the human realm, we have two kinds of relationship: a lower kind, which is more like an animal, where woman is a, you know, factory to have children, her place is inside the house because she has periods, she has a child, and she has to just bring up the children for the sake of the man, for his wants to continue, and all that nonsensical things. And man has to go out, he has to earn the bread, he is the breadwinner, and the woman has to listen to him. Now, this is the play of falsehood. One has to get rid of it entirely if one wants to lead even a higher human life. In the higher human life, not yet spiritual, man and woman work together in every sphere. So we see this thing has come now. You know, there are many men who are chefs, many men who, you know, home decors and arrangement, which was traditionally a woman's part. At least world over it's happening. As I said, some portions of the world, some religions are very hardcore still fixed to stereotypes. So this stereotype is breaking. So where man and woman come together, they complement each other. They can do each other, you know, it's not like you need a woman to cook your food. So they come together. And yet the beauty is that the harmony is because there are certain things which the man is in pursuit of something like a great ideal, because at the human level, that's the highest you can do. And the woman is who is also committed to the same ideal, but she is the one who organizes and helps in its manifestation. So a higher ideal where a kind of relationship can develop. From there, it can be it would be logically the spiritual freedom. And in that spiritual freedom, woman loses completely this role of the animal instinct producing children. Well, people often ask, then who will produce children? Don't worry, there'll be enough at the animal level who want to have only children. And that's how there's a hierarchy in evolution, and you can't help it. So spiritual freedom is where a woman discovers that she is one with the divine, and the man discovers he is one with the divine. They are equal. But the feminine manifests all that is like a possibility in the masculine. And let's take it, because biologically we are still that, the man and the woman, the masculine and the feminine. So this is the larger canvas, broadly speaking, of the origin of the man-woman. There is a truth in it. And we see that it gets distorted, finally comes several rungs down. At animal levels, it's still okay. But when it comes to human and the play of perversity and falsehood comes in, it becomes what we see today. It has to go step by step, first form a higher human relationship, and then the spiritual relationship where they both support each other's energies, each other's work, that process of ascension and manifestation of spiritual life here upon earth, so that heaven and earth can become equal and one. This is how the ancient seers saw the relation. Men as heaven, in the sense they are receiving like sky, not heaven exactly, but the sky. So they receive like space, internet, so they are receiving the idea. Woman is earth. So what does the earth do? So they saw the relation like sun and earth from where we started. Sun has so many possibilities. The feminine energy within it, they are one, Ishvara and Shakti. So feminine energy is the kiran, the rays, the light, the power inside the sun. That comes to earth. Now on the earth, all these possibilities begin to manifest by the touch of light. Life awakes, plants smile, animals gamble, human beings feel the call of the higher consciousness. They strive, all because the sun and the earth unite. Earth has always been a portion of the sun. She has come out of the sun, is nourished by the sun. And without earth, nothing inside the sun could ever manifest. So they are one, yet two, for the sake of manifestation, both equal in terms of their usefulness. Their roles are different. So that's why Prithvi Mata hai, Akash Pita hai. So earth is the mother because she gives birth to all these things, and Akash is Pita. One last thing with which I'll stop. So this concept has been very strongly embedded in Indian psyche, and that's why I think the resurgence in the true sense, we saw the distortion in the Western world, but the true sense will come in India, because in India, always this is how we have seen the feminine. Look at it, that of all the nations, all the countries are fatherly figures, or father, in nations, but we regard Bharat as Mata, country's mother, because he has many creative potentialities. And that's why you see India is a land of creative chaos. So many kinds of anything you pick up, from food to dance forms. And interestingly, both men and women come. Very few people probably can see it that way. But look at the Indian god Krishna and Shiva, two gods. The dances, music, art, culture, their influence is so much worldwide. So we need to go back to that original relation between the masculine and the feminine. Right now in a man body and female body, but eventually a new body which will be free of even this differentiation. It will be a body where the masculine, the feminine will express without the biological differences that we see today, which strongly create sexual attraction, etc., because of nature's inferior brain. So this is the path we have to take, and nature will take it. Who will walk that path and go through the full journey is something which time will tell. Namaste, Jayama. If there are questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Good evening, sir, and thank you so very much for such insights. The way you have like Akash Pita hai aur Prithvi Mata hai. So in the morning session today only, ma'am was talking about oneness. Instead of samatva ekatva ki baat ki thi unhone. To iska aapki baat se bahut zyada link lag raha hai mujhe.
Haan, bilkul, bilkul. Bilkul, bilkul. Pehle humko us ek ko janna hai. We have to discover that. Without that, as I said, we cannot enter into differentiation. If we try it prematurely, then there'll be a chaos, confusion.
Yes, sir. And likewise, nowadays a pseudo feminism is there. The way you were talking about.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we all should speak up, because see why these false narratives continue is because people who there are as such very few people who are looking at things with a deeper reflection, who are even striving to understand things. And therefore, these false narratives have their place. So I'm so glad that, people like now Shweta is there, and many of you, I'm sure, who are trying to speak up. This is very good. And not only speak up, actually express it in life and action. As I said, when I see women who are actualizing themselves, it's so wonderful. Who don't limit their role only to, childbirth and family. That still continues because of the biological and the old consciousness, but that's not what has to be taken as the ultimate. Yeah.
One more thing. Is it like feminism exists because of the, you may say, hatred against men or something like that?
It's a revolt, actually, and I won't say that the revolt didn't have a meaning. Well, it is true that when distortion came, as I said, once men started much later, it's not in the beginning, at least when we read our literature, which is way, way back old, we see a different kind of relationship. But as it came down several rungs, take for instance, even Krishna in Dwapar, which is just about 7,000 years back, 4,500 years back, the Mahabharata war. So anyway, so during that time, Braj ki holi, women and men are dancing together. It's a different thing altogether. Not the way we understand today in terms of a vital romantic relation. Satya Bhama and Krishna go together to fight the war. So this it comes much later in the play. And as I said, largely from another side of the world. And that has led to the distortion where, and India especially got impacted under the invasions. So it got confused between two kinds of dharma. There was the Victorian idea of morality, which came from the Western world, which just after the Islamic invasion, because of which you see in particularly in the northern parts of India, so many things which came right from the Islamic aspect. Parda, which was like the unfortunate equivalent of burqa, and then many other things came, soha ki nishani, etc. Basically because of the war and many of the vrat upvas, because of all this invasion, that tendency that when there is an invasion to defend, the community shrinks, so it loses its wideness. So we see that happening. So this is not what the truth of the relationship is. And then when women revolted, then they revolted. They had a reason for it. But they must understand that, okay, it's fine. But that's not the route that one has to take. There is something much greater and higher that awaits us. So that now the revolt is like adolescence, when something you find new, a newfound freedom. But now you have to go steps further, steps way beyond.
One more thing, the way you have said about the Vrat Upvas, so today also people keep it like fast.
Yeah, for the sake of, so I often used to wonder, why is a woman doing Karwa Chauth for the man? Okay. A man is not doing for the woman. Ideally, doesn't it mean that he also wants the woman to live long? Now, if you go back, you see that this Vrat, for example, I'm talking of only one Vrat. It's taking place largely in those belts which are invaded by the warring tribes. So if you go down south, just tell me, where is Karwa Chauth done? So this was because warring tribes were, you know, people, because if the man died, then the woman had a real danger of being run into the hands of the invaders who were cruel, barbaric, and they would, you know, every kind of unspeakable things they would do. So man's life became very important for a woman. That's how some women took to Johar, which we see. So all this was later because of the barbaric invading tribes. But otherwise, if you go to its roots, now we are not being invaded. It's like, now we don't need to do those things. Yes, both should pray together and pray for each other. That's perfectly fine. But that should not become the continue like a model. That's what it is.
Sir, but I am single, but I do Ekadashi like right from my childhood. So
that's a different thing. See, Ekadashi Vrat is a different thing. That's a fasting as a, that's a different discussion altogether, whether fasting helps in spiritual progress or not. That's a different subject. Men also do Ekadashi, women also do Ekadashi. And many men and women do these things as prayers for, because they think that by fasting and prayer, it will help me in spiritual progress. Now, I'm not entering into it deliberately because it's a very vast subject. But for instance, also there are some justifications, like there is a Hoi Athe Vrat. I don't know, some of you may be aware, which women do for sun. There's also the Chhat Parv. Now, that's where we can understand it in this way, that, a woman, when she prays and does Vrat, because she is a heart-centered, open to the psychic, probably her prayer carries a lot more weightage. To that extent, we can say. We see that in the story of Jalandhar and Vrinda and things like that. Because she is heart-centered, she is full of faith, unlike men who will roam in the realm of ideas. To that extent, yes. But to make that as a ritual, as a rule of life, which everybody must do, whether they feel for it or not, or as if it is not done, big calamity will fall. Spiritual life becomes more and more independent of these outer aspects. But in religious life, they have a place. So we must understand the difference between a religious life, which is more centered around the outer, and spiritual life, which is more inner-centering. This is a fundamental difference. When you go and take bath in the Triveni outside, it's a religious life. It has its purpose. That's a different subject again. But when you take bath in the inner Triveni, it's spiritual life. It's not that one cancels the other. Both can coexist. In India, they have coexisted. Not all can contact the inner Triveni, so it's all right. You can go there and be full of faith and that energy. So, okay. But one must know the difference. That's all. Yeah.
Hello. Thank you so much.
I ask one question?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Would it be right to say that both the aspects, the feminine and the masculine, lie in the same person? Like
absolutely. 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 They lie in the same person when we talk about the manifesting power and the ideative power. Both lie in the same person. I started with that, you know, very few people gave the example of Shivaji Maharaj, who combined idea and practicality, which is masculine and feminine, and bringing them out through contact is the lower nature's method. When we access spiritual freedom, then they come together. But usually, even in spiritual freedom, when we discover the feminine element, a man discovers or the woman discovers the masculine element, still for the sake of the way this creation exists, it becomes a lot more easier if the masculine aspect fulfills one role and the feminine can do another. It can exist. One person can do both. But it's so much easier and so much better. That's the origin of Ishvara and Shakti. But yes, the Shakti always holds Ishvara in her heart. And the Ishvara always holds Shakti in his heart. So it goes like that, yes. But even in that completeness, for manifestation, there is a difference. That's the only thing. That if you go beyond manifestation, there is no difference. But for manifestation, these are the two lines which Ishvara himself has chosen. So it's to facilitate. It's a kind of arrangement, we can say. But yes, both exist in the same individual. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One last question, Alokda, if you have time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Rashmi Ranjanji is asking, I think it's more a request. He's saying, Namaste Dada, any words for men who want to play their role as partners for upliftment and emancipation for women?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
They should get rid of this false pride to start with. This, so many words, probably it may be a little harsh. So I don't know. Men suffer from this intellectual arrogance. I'm again saying not most. And the reason why this has happened, partly because of the leaning on Purusha, the Vedanta and Purusha, 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 we started believing we are the Purusha, men. The second element is that men, because they can play with ideas, unlike women who express, and because it's a largely mentalized society, we are still living in the rational curve, not yet entered the psychic and the intuitive, which is going to come. And the signs are that the feminine power is taking over. Because of the rational world, analytical world, which is the forte of men, men started believing that we are superior. There can be nothing more absurd than that. So I feel men should tone down. So, and women are doing their toning down and dressing down, which is very happy. I'm so happy about it that men have to learn so much from women. Men have to see the winds of change. It's the era of Shakti. Shurabindu has put Shakti in front. Whether you like it or not, woman is going to rule the world tomorrow. So, because see the manifesting power. All our great goddesses, Ila, Mahi, Saraswati, Lakshmi, all of them are feminine. Masculine element has to support from behind. He has to be that way that, he's the sanctioner of all that, which is where there's a great role. But I'm not sure men are listening. Women are compelling them to listen. So, yes. shift will take place regardless of what men think or don't think. It's something which is going to take place in many areas. I could go on where they are. For example, for some time back also, there were many things which were okay for men but not okay for women. I could, speak any number of things. I'm talking of at the most, outermost animal level now, okay? Because things start from there. Why is it that the onus of fidelity is only for the woman, not on men? I mean, see, that way, so entire society was structured around a woman serving a man. This is too ordinary, and all this must go. And I'm sure it is going to go. It's just a question of time. The spirit of time is broken. Yeah. And if a man tries to, all that I can say to women is, if a man tries to bully you, tell him you are Durga, you are Kali, you are Shakti. Awaken that Parvati in you, before whom even Shiva falls at the feet. Awaken that power in you. That power will come only with a spiritual awakening. It cannot come as long as women choose to live within a frame. As I said, you have to be free from the slavery. So men also must should stop treating women as a pleasure object and only as, that image of a fragile, tender, coy woman who is trying to please. All this should go. These are stereotypes. Women can be strong. She can know, judo, karate, boxing, go in military, everything. That is the new, like Kali. It should be like that. That is changing. Things are changing, fortunately.
So, sir, according to you, a woman can be intuitive and intellectual at the same time.
Both, but she primarily drives her power from intuition. She uses intellect to express things which she has drawn from the intuition. That's why in a certain sense she is superior. Whereas men will arrive at the same thing. See, there is a difference between logicizing and trying to arrive at something higher. And quite another to have intuitively ready and expressing it through logic. There is a difference.
And one more thing.
Yeah.
The way we like हम जो सरस्वती माता की आरती गाते हैं, so what is the real मतलब कब से ये स्टार्ट हुआ, मुझे इसका हिस्ट्री अगर आप बता सकें. लाइक बैठी मेरी एक लाइन जो फेवरेट है वो है, बैठी मंथरा दासी रावण संहार किया. सो वॉट एग्जैक्टली इट इज?
नहीं, सरस्वती हैज द वॉरियर एस्पेक्ट टू हर. इट इज नोन. It is known in the Vedic times itself. So the worship of Saraswati, of all the other goddesses, if you ask me, Lakshmi, Parvati come later. Radha
okay.
comes later. Saraswati is the only goddess
so
who is mentioned in the Vedas.
Manifestation of Brahma, from Brahma?
She is the creative power. That's why. She is the creative power. She can destroy very easily. She knows the creation. It's like she knows she has to just undo it. So she is the tremendous power. She would not normally, because it's a creation, her creation she loves. But it's very easy. She is like, if I have to use a modern language, a super technologist who knows every nut and bolt of something. All that she has to do is untie one nut. So that's why we have actual battles of Saraswati. But her sanghar is very different. It's with a finish. All
okay,
that she
sir.
Needs to do is just do that. She has to just sit on the mouth of Kumkaran and make him say, what did he say? Nidrasan. Instead,
yes.
She can do like that. Yeah.
And one last thing. Pushkar temple, Brahma temple. So what exactly is the relation with Brahma temple and Lord Goddess Saraswati?
Well, there is a whole story with regard to why Brahma is not worshipped anywhere except Pushkar, but not going into it since you asked Brahma and Saraswati, because there is a story which is often misquoted that Brahma fell in love with Saraswati and therefore one of his head had to be cut by Shiva. So the story I can narrate to you that, you know, Brahma saw Saraswati, he brought out Saraswati out of him and then he fell in love with Saraswati. It's regarded as moha. The word is that he became fell in moha. So wherever Saraswati was going, he was following her. And then to escape Brahma, the story is told like that, she goes up. So Brahma grows a fifth head and he begins to chase her. Now Shiva comes and, you know, removes that fifth head. So the story is very interesting that Brahma is the person who has to support the creation from behind. If he starts having moha on the creation, because Saraswati, she is the power that is creating, then he won't be able to create. So he has to step back, become the witness and the ideator. The other part is Saraswati goes up and he begins to chase. Now that's premature because Brahma has four heads looking in four directions of space. He's exceeding his brief. So that is for later, and that's why the fifth head has to go away. So this is one of the stories, obviously wrongly understood, because when you create something, so one part of you flows into the creation. And this another part, we should always be step back and watch over it. Any action. Otherwise, you may actually end up in a ditch while creating. So the two are complementary, but Brahma falls in love with what is being created. That is the whole story. He should not do that. And it applies to all of us at one level. That if we just keep on writing, creating, but we are not able to step back and look at it, we are in the same position like Brahma. So we have to step back. But the story is told like many mythological stories wrapped in certain, you know, cultural symbols, which we have forgotten today. Yeah.
But there is Ved Mata, Gayatri Ji and Brahma and
That's a different story. So as I said, I'm not getting into it. That'd be a very vast subject. Okay.
Sir, I'm from Rajasthan only, so we visited.
Yeah. No, I understand. I love stories. But again, that would be a different subject. whether she is Savitri and Saraswati, or I have written about it to a question somebody had asked me. By the way, if there are any questions, anybody can ask me on Ask Alokda, where I regularly people post questions and I reply. So this question somebody had asked, actually, whether Gayatri is same as Savitri and Saraswati. So I had replied to that.